This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. San Luis Obispo's Cal Poly made a big fundraising announcement over the weekend. We sat down with Cal Poly's president to find out more about the university's plans for the future.
Diversity, inclusion, and climate on our campus, we need to better reflect California, provide opportunities for these high-achieving students.
Also, we'll hear about the sleep disorder narcolepsy from a local patient advocate.
I hate that it took almost 5 years to get a diagnosis because it was such a struggle, and I feel like I slept through those years. I don't feel like I had a life.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, May 6th, 2019. I'm Tyler Pratt. Winter rain created lush green hillsides across California. Soon, summer heat will dry out the growth, creating fuel for wildfire. To prepare, Governor Gavin Newsom ordered the prevention work in vulnerable communities across the state. He announced the plan in late March.
We've got to be much more proactive. 1.9 million acres burned last year.
Also, tens of thousands of homes and hundreds of lives were lost. So to speed up fire prevention efforts, Newsom lifted environmental regulations for 35 priority projects. This despite the protest of groups like the Sierra Club. From our sister station, KAZU, Erica Mahoney picks up this story here on the Central Coast in the mountains south of Carmel Valley, where one of the projects is underway.
At the end of a windy road, 40 minutes from Carmel Valley, there's a private community called White Rock Club. About 100 cabins are nestled in the mountains. Most are second homes. On this day, the sound of chainsaws echoes between towering trees. A 20-person crew is decked out in yellow hard hats and green cargo pants. They're clearing brush and cutting off low-hanging tree branches along White Rock Ridge.
All right, you guys all know Jonathan.
Cal Fire forester Jonathan Pangburn talks to the crew about a swath of trees they're working in.
Looking back into the area of madrones over here, it's really starting to get cleaned up.
They've got a lot of work ahead of them. This project spans 10,000 acres. It's called the Palo Corona White Rock Fire Roads Project. Work will be done by hand and heavy equipment, reducing vegetation along the ridgeline and access roads. Pangburn says they're working in this area because it's a strategic location for fighting wildfire. About 3 years ago, this is where firefighters held back the Soberanis fire.
White Rock Ridge ended up being, for a large portion of it, the primary fire control line during the Soberanis fire that kept it from entering into Carmel Valley.
This narrow ridgeline stands between the Los Padres National Forest and the homes in Carmel Valley.
This is our last resort. This line right here is like our last spot to hold fire before it goes through thousands of homes.
This is one of five priority projects happening across the Monterey Bay area. These forest management projects range from creating fuel breaks to reducing vegetation. The governor waived the California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA, to speed up the work. CEQA requires identifying and mitigating environmental impacts, then sharing that information with the public. Sierra Club California Director Catherine Phillips says that was the wrong move.
I think as a public interest organization, we're always anxious for more information, not less.
Phillips is concerned about long-term impacts to wildlife, habitat, and other natural resources.
How do we make sure that what they're doing doesn't endanger those? California Environmental Quality Act is a checking mechanism. And when government starts destroying those checking mechanisms, it creates uncertainty about how well they're doing their job.
Cal Fire's Jonathan Pangburn says although they don't have to follow CEQA, it's still informing how they're approaching the Palo Corona White Rock project.
There are a number of species and other resources of concern in our area here on the Central Coast that we are absolutely making sure to protect as part of our overall project design.
Also, the state requires these projects have a professional forester on site. Nadia Hamey is the one working on this project. She leans against her gray truck just before heading out to the project site. There, she'll identify plants and animals that need to be protected.
The California red-legged frog and the California tiger salamander This Miss Blue butterfly, as I mentioned, is a buckwheat-dependent species.
She's got a lot of supplies in the back of her truck, an ATV, detailed maps, and flags. She'll use the flags to mark habitats that CAL FIRE crews should not clear out.
We are hanging flags on every plant specimen that we want retained. So in the case of elderberry, if we have a whole patch of elderberry, we might, you know, have 15 flags kind of in the surround, and that's a key to the operators to leave it alone.
Hamie says doing this work proactively allows crews to give more care than during an emergency. That's when dozers can haphazardly destroy these natural resources. Work on this project will likely take most of the year. Erica Mahoney, KAZU News.
Remember the 35-day government shutdown in late December and January? Well, it halted federal wildfire preparations throughout the country. Former KCBX reporter and host Bree Zender recently uncovered key burn opportunities that were missed during that period in the Sierra Nevadas. In some areas, prescribed burns won't happen until later in the spring because there is simply too much snow. Bree is now at Reno Public Radio Station KUNR and sat down with news director Michelle Billman to discuss her findings from mining interagency data to see the effect the shutdown had on the area.
So you set out to find out how the shutdown affected prescribed burns. How did you go about doing that?
Well, first I started talking with some folks at the U.S. Forest Service and, you know, go to the source and see what they had to say, but I didn't really get too far. The media representatives on the national level wouldn't let the employees really talk about what was going on concerning the shutdown. They could only say, you know, we are assessing the situation, and they didn't point me in any particular direction. However, the Forest Service works with a lot of other federal, state, and local agencies on these treatments, so I tried contacting those people. I ended up talking with some folks from the National Weather Service, at CAL FIRE, and at local interagency organizations. And eventually I was brought to this data set displaying all the prescribed burns and other types of wildfire prep treatments in California.
Yes, that data set. I remember you going through all of that information. How long did it take you to track all of that?
I mean, altogether, it probably took me around like 24 hours or so. I was camped out of my desk and at work and at home. I had to click through this map on each individual fire. And if you didn't know, California is a giant state with a lot of prescribed burns. So I had to look up all of these treatments one by one and basically make my own data set.
And so now that you have this information, I mean, what do we take away from it?
So we'll likely never really know like an exact amount of acres that were missed in burning, because every day is just so up in the air because it's dependent on the weather, how many workers are available. However, you know, we can track what happened beforehand, and things are really ramping up beforehand. In just the 3 weeks before the shutdown, the U.S. Forest Service burned about 9,000 acres throughout California, and things were really ramping up. Based on the folks that I've talked to at the National Weather Service, there were some clear good burning days that they couldn't burn.
We've talked a lot about the shutdown, but then right after that, there was a ton of snow in the Tahoe region. What kind of impact did that have?
So with this historic snowpack, some of the higher elevations received over 600 inches of snow. But usually for prescribed burns, a bit of snow is a good thing, especially for pile burns, which is one of the main wildfire prep treatments in the mountains. But these piles are usually 4 or 5 feet tall, and with all of that snow, you just can't reach the piles so that you can burn them.
And now that we have this information from your reporting and we're a couple months out from the shutdown, I mean, what's next?
Well, these agencies are just doing their best to prepare for the next wildfire season. Local, state, and fire officials have told me that with a heavy snowpack, there's going to be a lot of water to feed those plants, so there's going to be a lot more fuel for this upcoming fire season. However, because it was such a moist winter, there's going to be more time to do these prescribed burns before the bulk of the wildfire season starts ramping up. Also, the Tahoe National Forest is now resuming prescribed burns in the Tahoe Basin now that some of the snow has melted, but weather is always permitting for every burn. So.
Right. And, I mean, the government shutdown ended more than 2 months ago, and the news cycle has largely moved on from it. We're not hearing a lot of impact stories at this point. I mean, why should we be talking about this?
Well, several lawmakers, including Nevada Senator Jackie Rosen, have signed a letter back in February saying that they're gravely concerned about the effects on wildfire prep in the West. And also, we as the public haven't really seen a clear answer on this. Fire season is going to be upon us pretty soon.
As for the state of California, they're really trying to, you know, make up for this. California Governor Gavin Newsom has declared a state of emergency and has called on the National Guard to assist on the work.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. You can find Bree Zender's reporting along with the data set that she built at KUNR.org. Bree, thanks so much.
Thanks, Michelle.
For KUNR News, I'm Michelle Billman.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. Next, we learn about the sleep disorder narcolepsy. It's estimated that around 200,000 people in the United States have the disorder, but only 50,000 are properly diagnosed. Here's KCBX's Greta Mart in conversation with a local woman with narcolepsy, talking about the different types of the disorder, how it affects her daily life, and why its portrayal in movies and on TV doesn't quite match up to reality.
My name is Ashley Allen, and I am a patient advocate for sleep disorders, and I'm a local. I grew up here on the Central Coast. I have narcolepsy, which is a chronic neurological disorder.
What is narcolepsy? How does it happen? How does it manifest itself?
Most of the time in TV, they show it like someone just instantly falls asleep, like in their bowl of soup or something like that, and that's actually not what happens, so it's a misconception. And which is a problem because a lot of people with narcolepsy, it takes a really long time to get a diagnosis because not only does the general public have misconceptions, but so do physicians. So basically, some of the primary symptoms of narcolepsy are excessive daytime sleepiness. That one's pretty across the board. That's definitely how I knew something was wrong with me. And then there are actually two types of narcolepsy. There's one with cataplexy and one without cataplexy. And cataplexy is the complete loss of muscle control that happens quickly, and it happens with strong emotions. So things like being excited or mad or laughing can trigger it. And it can be anything from like a jaw drop, like drooping, or it can be all the way where someone will completely collapse onto the floor. And they are awake when that happens, but they lost their muscle control. So that's probably where the media gets the falling asleep in their soup. But unfortunately, that's not how it actually works. And then there are other symptoms, such as there are hallucinations upon falling asleep and waking up. They can be really realistic or scary. Their sleep paralysis is a common symptom. My sleep doctor and I are thinking that I have mild cataplexy because I have been recently having a lot of knee weakness when I get nervous. And I've noticed that I kind of stumble after I kiss my significant other. So I do think that there's some going on there. So we're going to kind of monitor it and see if it progresses.
Interesting. Okay, so when did you first get diagnosed and how did you come to that diagnosis?
So I didn't get a diagnosis until last year and my symptoms started. So I'm 30. I got a diagnosis when I was 29, and I started looking for a diagnosis when I was about 23 or 24 because I just was so tired all the time, and I was working two jobs. I had a full-time job, and I was a waitress. So I was like, I mean, I'm probably just tired because I'm working two jobs. But then I was realizing, you know, because I'd go home from work at 4:30 and go straight to bed if I didn't have to go work my waitressing job, and then I would sleep just so many hours, and then I would have a hard time staying awake at work. And I realized, like, this isn't normal. So I went to my primary care physician who heard my symptoms and was, I think you have lymphoma. I'm like 23, and she just told me she thinks I have cancer. So, I mean, my mind was completely blank. And then the test came back, and it didn't show any signs of cancer. And then she kind of just wrote it off and was like, oh, well, you're young and healthy. You're fine. And I kept going back and saying, no, I'm really tired. I mean, sometimes I would fall asleep in the waiting room. And she just didn't seem to think that it was anything. So I finally gave up for a little bit. And then about a year later, I found a physician that cared and was, let's do some tests because that's not normal.
What are the tests and how did they narrow it down?
So the test started with just your typical blood test, and it did test for things like if I had Epstein-Barr and some hormone tests, and every single physician I saw asked about depression because being tired is a symptom of depression. I had tests for adrenal fatigue syndrome. I did have some hormone imbalances. So then eventually when I had done pretty much every test that my physician could think of, she was like, I think it might be narcolepsy. I think it's time to go to a sleep specialist. So that's when I did the test for narcolepsy, which is, it's almost a 24-hour test. So you go into a sleep lab at nighttime and you sleep so that they can see what your normal night of sleep looks like. And then you have a daytime test where basically there are scheduled short naps that you have to take, and they measure the speed in which you fall into your dream sleep, REM sleep. Yeah, so it was a really long, tedious
Fascinating. Test. I wonder how they first figured out back in the day, like how do they even identify this as a its own distinct thing?
When you look at sleep disorders in general, there's some overlap. So it's actually estimated that the majority of people with narcolepsy are probably not diagnosed yet or are misdiagnosed. There's a lot of disorders with excessive daytime sleepiness. So cataplexy is pretty much the automatic sign that they're like, okay, yes, you have narcolepsy. And then the other type of narcolepsy without cataplexy is less well known. It's less well known as to what causes it, and it's harder to diagnose.
I see. Okay. And so once you went to the sleep lab and you got a diagnosis, were you finally like, this is it. I've identified it. You felt like, okay, it's been ID'd.
Yes. I mean, after years of being tested and struggling to have a social life and hold a job, I was so grateful. The diagnosis was a little confusing because the doctor, even after the test, was kind of struggling to decide if it was idiopathic hypersomnia or narcolepsy. And then it took a whole nother year to be like, yeah, it's narcolepsy because the symptoms. So, but I mean, either way, the treatment for both of those are the same. So I was so happy to have something to help me get back to some sort of normal life. It was really hard to make it through a work day before I had treatment.
Okay. And so treatment, are we talking medication?
Yeah. So there's different treatments. So they vary between patients. But there are stimulants that are wake promoting that you take for the daytime. And then some people take a sedative at nighttime that helps them sleep, because people with narcolepsy, it's not that we sleep all the time. It's that our sleep wake cycle is off. And so you can, you know, have uncontrollable tiredness during the day. And then at nighttime, you could be unable to fall asleep or unable to stay asleep. So some people will take sedatives at nighttime to sleep better. And then there are things like lifestyle changes, that kind of thing as well.
And so now you take the medication, and are your days a lot better, more manageable?
They absolutely got more manageable when I first started taking the medication. Unfortunately, right now I'm kind of having a decline in, this year has been much easier. I mean, I can make it through a work day. I still have days where I will go to bed kind of right after work, or a Saturday night that I go to bed at 7:30 at night. And so it's still an issue with like my personal life, my social life, my work life, but it's definitely improved to where I feel like I have a quality of life.
Okay. And are you supported? Like, does your job know? Did you tell like your boss, say, you know, this is what I have, or you kind of keep it separate? Or
I do. I don't feel like there's any reason not to share that. And I mean, part of the reason that there's low awareness is because people have there's stigma, or people are embarrassed, and I just don't see the point in hiding it. And I do think it's important, because occasionally I will have days where I need to go home because I'm just exhausted, or mornings where I'm like, you know what, I'm gonna have to come in a little bit late because I just can't get up right now. So it's important for them to know. And I do talk openly with them about it.
Okay. And what about your friends and your significant other? Are they supportive? I guess they would have to manage it in terms of maybe they won't get disappointed if you don't go out at 10 o'clock at night on a Saturday night, right?
Yeah. So there's a lot of disappointment. I've seen some of my friends kind of not be my friends anymore because, you know, you can't make early morning plans with me, or I will go to someone's like birthday party and then everyone's going to stay out till 2 a.m. and I'm like home by 9 o'clock. And I think because it's an invisible illness. So people think like, oh, come on, just sleep, you know, sleep later. You're fine. Some people have the inability to be able to be understanding. And then my significant other is very understanding. I think it's still probably disappointing and difficult when, you know, it's Saturday night. We've worked hard all week. We want to go out and have dinner. And I'm just like, I unfortunately am going to stay in bed. But very supportive. And yeah, I'm very thankful for that.
And so you say you're a patient advocate. And what does that mean? And what do you do?
So there's a nonprofit called Project Sleep. And their mission is to raise awareness about sleep health and sleep disorders. And they provide a training for, so it's called Rising Voices of Narcolepsy. And it's a writing or speaking training class so that you can be able to share your story and share what narcolepsy is. Because, I mean, the reason I do it is because I hate that it took almost 5 years to get a diagnosis, because it was such a struggle. And I feel like I slept through those years. I don't feel like I had a life. And so my goal is to spread awareness so that people know, so that physicians know, so that if someone that's experiencing a lot of excessive daytime sleepiness, they know there might be something going on. And that is one of the goals. So it's basically to correct misconceptions so that when someone's tired all the time, they're not going to be like, oh, well, you're not falling asleep, you know, at the drop of a hat. So it's not narcolepsy. So it's to get more awareness.
Right, right. Because somebody, you know, somebody could think, oh, that person's a druggie or something. You know, there's so many different things that could be put upon that, you know, or as you said, like with friends, oh, she's just not interested, or, you know, there's so many things that could be misidentified, I guess, about it. So that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And there's a good chance that, I mean, there, as I said, they think that most people that have it are undiagnosed or misdiagnosed. So, I mean, there's a good chance that people out there, you know, have someone in their life with narcolepsy. And it makes it a little less difficult if someone does have narcolepsy to be able to say, I have narcolepsy. Because, I mean, every time I say that to someone, the reaction is very interesting and it varies a lot. And if there was just more understanding of it in general, the reaction probably wouldn't vary as much. And I wouldn't have to go into so many details every time I share it.
This is something you'll have for the rest of your life.
Yes.
Okay. And so you're still kind of at the point where you're negotiating medications or just kind of working out the best treatment.
Yep. Trying to figure out what lifestyle treatments work, what medication treatments work, that kind of thing.
Okay, got it.
And if you think you're having some issues, definitely speak with your provider. And then if they're not listening to you, it might be time to get a second opinion. Just if you know something's wrong, you know your body better than anyone else. So it's up to you kind of to get things taken care of.
Okay. And the biggest sign would be just that it daytime sleeping, you're tired throughout the day. Not that you just suddenly fall asleep at your desk, but.
Yeah. It's like, so excessive daytime sleepiness is described as it's periods of time where you're so sleepy, it would be the equivalent of someone without narcolepsy not having sleep for about 48 to 72 hours.
Whoa.
So if you've ever done like the long flight traveling thing and you're up 24 hours, well, it's even worse than that. So it's, I mean, it's really hard to not fall asleep when you're having those. So when you're having periods of excessive daytime sleepiness throughout the day, that's something to be concerned with. And then obviously if you're noticing that with emotions, you have some sort of muscle weakness, if your knees are getting weak, if you're falling, if you're dropping things, those could be signs of cataplexy. So those are things that you would probably want to count as a red flag and talk to your provider.
Okay. Well, very informative. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Ashley Allen in a conversation with KCBX's Greta Mart. For more information on narcolepsy and other sleep disorders, visit project-sleep.com. Welcome back to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. Our next two guests came to the KCBX studios to talk about the Wine History Project of San Luis Obispo County. The project's mission is to preserve the story of Central Coast winemaking. KCBX's Greta Mart speaks with the project's founder and staff historian to learn more.
I am here in the KCBX studio with, may I ask you to introduce yourself? I'll start with you on my right.
Sure. Heather Moran, historian with the Wine History Project.
Okay, great. And you?
I'm Libby Agrin, and I'm the executive director of the Wine History Project in San Luis Obispo.
Okay, great. So tell me, what is the Wine History Project?
Well, the Wine History Project, it really started with Libby back in 2015, and it was really her vision to help to really gather all the history, both collecting through collections and education, to really help promote and collect the history of San Luis Obispo's viticulture, winemakers, and just the people. And it started, I don't know, how many people started the Wine History Project back at that time, Libby?
I started it actually myself. I had this idea that I wanted to leave a legacy of history about agriculture. And in the end, after walking and hiking with Don Campbell, who is a local agricultural historian, many, many acres of the county, we were kind of like an archaeological dig, looking to see how had this land been used and what had been grown on it. And as we came to the end of our many travels around the county, we decided together that really talking about the wine industry, because we could look forward to a lot of impact in the future. Now, this was in 2015 when we were doing this. And our second step was to go out and talk to, over 100 people in the both ag industry and wine industry to say, how can we form the project so it will be a lasting archive that historians can look at 100 or 200 years from now? So it was the input of many people that helped form it.
So this project, is it online or is it based somewhere?
It certainly is. It's based right here in San Luis Obispo, and we're at 3592 Broad Street behind the Black Horse Bakery. We have a staff. We have two historians on the staff. We have an archivist. We have a collections manager. We have a resource specialist, and we contract with a film crew in Napa, California. So we have a very active staff and a lot of storage space and a lot of collections to tell you about.
I see. Okay. Is it open to the public or what? Is it just behind the scenes or how does it work?
Well, it works in a couple different ways. So several exhibits are actually ongoing right now. We just opened an exhibit up in Paso Robles at the Historical Society up there.
It's about the beautiful bottles that were used to store wine during the Gold Rush period. So we're talking about people coming to California to seek for gold and drinking wine and having bottles to store it in. And that leads us, of course, back to 1848, 1850s. We also have an exhibit nearby celebrating Gary Eberle's winery's 40th anniversary. And when you walk into the winery, you'll see a huge wall of outdoor exhibits telling about his life, starting from birth all the way to the present, but also really importantly talking about the impact of his winery and his visions, all the visions he brought to our county that created the Paso Robles AVA, the wine festivals in our county, the first plantings of Syrah and Cab. It's a very interesting historical exhibit, and he just loves it.
Okay, and let's backtrack to the exhibit about wine bottles from the 1850s. Where did you get these? Where did you find these bottles?
We have a collections manager named Cindy Lambert, and she and I explore all around the country to try to find things to add to our collections. So some things we buy, some things are donated. We happened to see an American Pickers segment on television on the National Geographic channel, and we've discovered a museum in Northern California of wine history that was going out of business. So a lot of the bottle collections we have are from purchasing from that collection.
Oh, interesting. Okay. And what are some other collections you've got going on?
So we do have another one that's closing just this weekend. It's Wine Becomes Art, and that's at actually SLOMA, the Slow Museum of Art in downtown San Luis Obispo. That one features several different wine bottles and really beautiful works of art in combination. And it really, it focuses kind of on three different projects, the first being the Harvest Festival, which was ran by the vintners and growers of Edna and Arroyo Grande Valley back in the early 80s. So you'll see some great works of art by a local cellar hand from Edna Valley Vineyard, who actually did the art for the posters and promotional efforts for some of the first harvest celebrations. And then in addition to that, we are also featuring the Mano Tinta Project, which was founded by Brian and Johnine Talley from Talley Vineyards. It's a great program where all the proceeds from the Mano Tinta wines are donated to the Farm Workers, Vineyard and Farm Workers Program. And it's a great endowment that really helps those families, those migrant families, through different nonprofits. And so that is actually another exhibit that's ongoing there. And then the Central Coast Wine Classic, we have a wide collection of really beautiful hand-etched bottles, as well as the artwork that was collected through the Central Coast Wine Classic and through Archie McLaren's work. As you know, Archie passed away last year, but we were able to carry on his legacy through this exhibit, as well as a new book that we just released in February.
Got it. Okay. What's that book like? Tell me about that book.
Well, we have the collection of and logging and archiving the history is half our project, and the other half is reaching out to the public. So we do that through six different methods. One of them is publishing books. So this one is about Archie. It's about the story he wanted to tell through interviews the last year of his life that I spent interviewing him and working with him. So it's from Memphis, where he was born. His journey to California, and it's about his impact on our county by bringing it to national and international attention and pairing our winemakers with winemakers all through the U.S. and Europe, and bringing a new food culture to our county as well. And so the books in the future will be about other individuals who have made an unusual and wonderful impact on the county. So the exhibits Heather was telling you about, we have the books. We have just completed shooting two documentaries, one on the Ducey family, which is four generations of very, very important growers in California of Zinfandel. And also we have just finished working with Gary Eberle, and we'll be doing a whole film that focuses on North County and his role in North County.
Interesting. Okay.
We've been doing a lot of featured projects and events through the Food History Project as well, which is kind of an offshoot from the Wine History Project. And it's really our efforts to educate the general public about the wine history as well as the food history, as those two really tie together. They pair so well with each other. And so that's really part of another kind of part of what we're doing with the Wine History Project is actually through retelling some of those stories. And we've had a couple great events. We just recently hosted one at Slow Provisions. It's every month we meet the first or second
it's
Monday,
the
second Monday of the month. And at 5:30, we usually meet at Slow Provisions. And we usually have a guest speaker. We've had lots of different speakers in the past.
And so tell me, how are you guys different from the Slow County History Center?
We're actually not like them at all. We formed our organization through a very large group of people in the community participating. And in the end, the people who actually helped me found it included Archie and Bob Haas, Gary Eberle, people who helped me select the wine makers, growers, and events in history that changed history. So there are probably about 57 of them in North County that we're working on, and 30 to 40 in South County, and another 15 or 20 just right around downtown San Luis Obispo. And one of those is is Pierre Daliday, who was the first commercial wine maker in the county, a first licensed and bonded one. So we're not a nonprofit. We have private funding, and therefore we are able to put a lot of effort and money and resources into gathering this history, which is a long and wonderful but expensive process. Our exhibits, which we believe not in having a museum, so we are a museum without walls in a sense. We create them and we take them out and put them in the public arena so that when you go to a winery or you go to the Paso Robles Historical Society or Studios on the Park or wherever you go, you're going to bump into the history. And we're using some pretty cutting edge technology and really interesting designs so that people can really learn something from it. And interact with it. We didn't want to be a museum with walls. We don't want to be affiliated with any of the traditional ways that this kind of history has been told. We want to do something entirely new, and we're having a ball doing that.
That was Casey Bex's Greta Martin conversation with Heather Muren and Libby Agran of the Wine History Project of San Luis Obispo County. More information can be found at the project's website, winehistoryproject.org. You're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Tyler Pratt. San Luis Obispo's Cal Poly has launched a massive fundraising campaign. It's called The Power of Doing, the campaign for Learn by Doing. It's the largest fundraising effort in the university's history, hoping to raise $700 million. Just before the campaign was announced, I sat down with Cal Poly President Jeffrey Armstrong and Vice President of Development and CEO of the Cal Poly Foundation, Matthew Ewing, to talk about the university's plans to get that money, what they plan to do with it, and Cal Poly's plans for the future as it works to rebrand itself as a more accessible and diverse school for students of all types of backgrounds.
We're excited to launch the public phase of our campaign, The Power of Doing, and it's geared to drive Learn by Doing. And no surprise to people that know Cal Poly, Learn by Doing is key to our students' success, success of our alumni. So Learn by Doing was born here, and it's going to thrive here forever. But to do that, we need private support from our alumni, donors, corporations, and others to supplement the money from the state, as well as our students and parents. So when I arrived in 2011, we had completed a campaign many years before. The first one in the CSU was completed at Cal Poly in 2004. And so we knew that we wanted to enhance private support at Cal Poly. And the best way to do that is through engaging our development professionals, building a campaign. And it's really about building relationships and growing relationships, finding donor passion, where they have an interest, and it's about, you know, funding things that we would fund anyway, but getting it done faster, and sometimes just simply getting it done.
What are some of the things that are looking to be funded?
We've been in a silent phase of the campaign since we're on a fiscal year, so our fiscal year 2013. For the past 6 years, we've been really building both the momentum for this campaign and really the priorities. As the president said, it's about learn by doing, but learn by doing means something different for everyone. To date, we've raised more than $556 million towards this campaign. Those are both gifts very large. I think of Bill and Linda Frost, who committed $110 million to the university, down to the gifts of $1 to $5 that still make an impact on the aggregate. 164,000 gifts make up that $556 million for more than 50,000 donors. But the campaign, as we move into the public phase, is about opening that door to more, inviting other people into the family, and showing them how they can participate. The campaign has three pillars: empowering students, empowering excellence, and empowering innovation. The priorities underneath that are all about our students, all about our faculty and our staff, both in breaking down the barriers if it's a student in terms of getting them to Cal Poly and making sure they're successful, and then giving our faculty and our staff the resources, the facilities, and the technology to allow Learn by Doing to thrive.
When you say resources and facilities, are there some new projects in the works?
Tomorrow we break ground on a new facility, the SATRC. That's a public partnership with both private funding coming from our supporters, also coming from the CSU via state support, and then an investment from the university as well. And that's a perfect way to show a partnership in terms of funding to allow Learn by Doing to thrive. And I think Jeff can talk a little bit about the specifics underneath that building.
So if you think about the SATRC, the Science, Agriculture, Teaching, Research Center, it's part of the bigger Bill and Linda Frost gift. And the whole goal there is to enhance student success through expanding undergraduate and master's research. But you need a place for it to occur. So $30 million of the $125 million project is coming from the Frost family, $10 million from the Boswell Foundation to support the Ag Tech Center, the Boswell Agricultural Tech Center. We had some anonymous donors, and then also a couple that near and dear to Cal Poly, Jack and Felicia Cashin, are supporting the liberal arts component of the building. Another example of empowering students, and we referred to earlier, breaking down barriers, is our Cal Poly Scholars. We started that several years ago. We have about 280 students right now, but we'll be expanding that and adding 300 students this fall. 82 of those will be partially or all funded through donors, through individual donors, companies like Northrop Grumman are supporting. And Cal Poly Scholars is targeted to high-achieving, economically disadvantaged California students that otherwise maybe wouldn't pick Cal Poly. They might stay home or not travel so far away. We found that we needed that extra financial aid to lower the cost of Cal Poly. Cal Poly is the highest cost public university net of financial aid, not loans, but net of financial aid. So Cal Poly Scholars is a great way to move that forward. We provide advising. The students live on campus 2 years. It's an amazing program, and it's going to be a real highlight and a strong thrust of the campaign for the next 2 years to grow Cal Poly Scholars.
Outside of this scholarship program, will we see any funds from fundraising that y'all will be doing going to benefit more of the student population as San Luis Obispo continues to be more of an expensive place to live and to avoid things like food insecurity and housing issues?
Yeah, that's actually a great point, the food insecurity and others. In fact, our foundation board started 4 years ago. Each and every member contributes to the Cal Poly Fund, Cal Poly Cares, or the Cal Poly Foundation Fund for Students. That's $200,000 a year, and we hope that they'll continue that into time. That's coupled with other donations. We've had some individuals contribute to Cal Poly Cares, and so if we know of a student that's homeless, we will provide housing, we provide food, we provide whatever they may need in case of emergency funding. Unfortunately, very difficult things happen where parents may drop out of the picture, deceased, whatever it may be, and students need help now. Cal Poly Cares steps up.
Gavin Newsom has proposed more funding to the CSU system, and more funding came through this year. Is it not enough for Cal Poly, what he's proposing?
So if you think about the power of doing and really driving Learn by Doing, state support is not adequate to maintain, let alone increase excellence. If you look at Cal Poly with our upside-down curriculum where the students start in their major, we have high investment majors. Engineering, agriculture, and architecture are high investment majors. And then our whole Learn by Doing pedagogy requires that additional investment. That's why we have the additional campus fees. From a sticker price, we're way under the UCs, but as I mentioned earlier, net cost of attendance after accounting for financial aid, that's an issue for us. So we're very pleased and gracious for the state support, but it's just frankly not enough, and we need that support. But it's also a way for us to leverage the state funds. In fact, the CSU Board of Trustees is very appreciative of donations. They're very appreciative of public-private partnerships, because I think from a taxpayer perspective, as I'm a California taxpayer, if we can leverage every dollar possible, then there's more more for other projects. We can reach more students. It's critical, and it's really an and both, not an either or.
Not working in fundraising, if I understand this correctly. This is a new campaign, and this is more to get the public involved. Am I correct in understanding this?
Well, so typically campaigns have a silent or leadership phase, and so alumni and many people are involved. And as Vice President Ewing said, we've raised over $550 million. The public phase is to draw more people in and to get them involved. So whether they're alumni or local community members, your listeners, we hope some will pick up the phone and say, I want to know what's going on at Cal Poly. How can I help Cal Poly Scholars? How can I help the beach volleyball team? How can I help the performing arts? How can I help the band or the symphony? Or it may be back to a major they attended, because that's where we see that alumni have that affinity back to their major, back to their department, or athletics, or I was in the band, whatever it may be.
I went to Columbia, and so now I've hit the point where they are asking me for money a lot, and I don't have it. So how do we convince alumni to give back to an educational institution?
The campaign, obviously, we're going to talk about a dollar goal. And fundraising financially is a big piece of that. But there's other ways for individuals to also contribute. How you can impact a student's life by serving as a mentor, by volunteering on one of our Dean's Advisory Council board, by helping to open doors to other people. Giving back to the university is not just financially. Now, at the end of the day, we do need the financial resources to actually move the needle forward. But as I mentioned earlier, every gift matters, every gift counts, every gift makes a difference. And whether that's a dollar you give when Columbia calls you or Cal Poly calls you to support your major, or a $110 million generous gift from Linda and Bill Frost, all of that helps us move forward and is important.
What goes into a $110 million gift like that? How does can you walk me through how that happens?
Yeah, the Bill and Linda Frost, it really goes back to relationships and experiences at Cal Poly. Bill was a student many years ago, and he studied chemistry. He had undergraduate research experiences that propelled him to a successful career. He was able to build companies. He sold his company, and then he wanted to give back. An assistant professor at that time by the name of Phil Bailey, they struck up a relationship that's been going on for 40 years. Phil just retired as Dean of College of Science and Math. So they worked together and built, the goal was to build the best undergraduate research program in the country, in the College of Science and Math. And in order to do that, we need a facility. So it's about scholarships to the best and the brightest. It's about funding for doing the actual work and funding for people to do the work. But it's all focused on providing the opportunity for students to experience what he experienced. And when he meets with the students every year, he says to them, I have one request for you. When you're successful, I want you to give back, whatever that might be.
I have to ask, it's been a tumultuous couple of years for the school. How do y'all expect or anticipate to field questions about activities at the school as y'all go about fundraising over the next few years?
Well, the power of doing and really focusing in on learn by doing, it's really about relationships and building relationships. We really focus on a donor-centric approach. Where's the donor's passion? Of course, we'll try to direct that. We may get someone interested in bricks and mortar that was not interested in bricks and mortar, but we never do anything that we wouldn't do ourselves if we had that adequate money. So we align that. And then we always answer our donors' questions and interact with them how as we move along. But we're very excited about the campaign and what that will mean for the future.
This campaign comes at a time of a new logo for the school, a new welcome center. Is there some rebranding going on at Cal Poly?
Well, this was not a coincidence that we had our work done with Simpson Scarborough, a professional firm, which was based on over 6,500 inputs, both qualitative and quantitative. And so the campaign is really a sub-brand of Cal Poly's overarching brand. And through the research and through the data, we found that there's room to grow Cal Poly's awareness, or people's awareness, I should say, of Cal Poly, especially as we are charging more for out-of-state students. And we're going to use that to provide support for those high-achieving, economically disadvantaged California students. All of that revenue and what we put into that is going to pay off for students down the road, because you have to make investments in order to reap the rewards later. And really, the rewards are for the students, driving student success.
And just finally here, I mean, we talked about the scholarship and assisting food insecurity and stuff. And what other ways will this new fundraising mechanism go towards supporting the economically disadvantaged students that I'm assuming you're trying to get at the school?
Yes, of course, the Cal Poly Scholars is a great example, and it's not just a scholarship, but it's enhanced advising. It's enhanced data programs so that we can actually use predictive analytics and provide the advising that each individual student needs. So as we expand Cal Poly Scholars to upwards of 3,000 students, we'll be expanding and enhancing the advising programs all over campus. So all students will benefit from the campaign. Then we also have individual donors that want to support mechanical engineering students. They want to support the beach volleyball team. So we have really multiple examples there of impact of students. And many of our student athletes are economically disadvantaged, and because they have that talent, they're given a scholarship, but they're also Cal Poly eligible because you are truly a student athlete at Cal Poly.
So the real message of this campaign, and this is why I love the narrative and the story that we'll put out, that our alumni have told us that they resonate with, connecting it back to Learn by Doing, is that this message continues on. We'll take a period of time to really thank and celebrate all those that helped us surpass and exceed the goal, but then we continue on the message, because in order for Learn by Doing to thrive here always, that partnership between scholarship and philanthropy needs to always be emerging. And so we'll continue on to raise those funds even after the campaign.
Yeah, in one sense, while we'll talk about the new goal later, we've already surpassed our original goal. Our original goal was $500 million when we first set out in 2013 and 14. What will this campaign be? We've already surpassed that. So it's an exciting time. And the other thing I would mention back to the brand, that's all about Learn by Doing as well. It's really Learn by Doing, day one ready. Our students, many people have told me over the years in my time here at Cal Poly that they love Cal Poly graduates. They have 2 feet on the ground and 2 hands on the problem. I think another way to capture Learn by Doing is an engineering student was contemplating, you know, this time of year a few years ago, what am I going to go to Cal Poly or not? And this student had been admitted to some really amazing engineering programs and had all the pros and cons written on the wall, and finally said to his parents, you know, I can study engineering at all these places, but I get to be an engineer at Cal Poly. That's the power of Learn by Doing.
What's your vision for the school when this fundraising campaign ends in 2021? Where do you see the school? What's your dream?
Well, we actually charted that out a few years ago and called it Vision 2022. And we want to be a more residential and more diverse campus. And when I have parents or prospects or folks from media ask me, what really worries you? What worries you in the future? It really boils down to 2 things. It's the diversity, inclusion, and climate on our campus. We need to better reflect California, provide opportunities for these high-achieving students. And it's also about our faculty and staff and providing the salaries and the ability for them to be successful. Now, flexible funding and donations are all part of that. But if we can achieve those 2 major goals, we'll have buildings, we'll have funding, we'll have donations. A lot of things will happen. But again, it gets back to Learn by Doing. Part of the power of Learn by Doing is constantly getting better. And that's my vision for Cal Poly, that we're constantly getting better. So when a student accepts Cal Poly this year or accepts a Cal Poly, you know, 10 years from now, they know that that degree is going to appreciate over time. And that's been happening and will continue to happen. But it's got to be powered by Learn by Doing.
That was Cal Poly's President Jeffrey Armstrong and Vice President Matthew Ewing talking about the power of doing, the campaign for Learn by Doing, Cal Poly's effort to raise $700 million by 2021. And finally today, before we go, a short history lesson with host Brian Reynolds and author Terry Canefield in discussing her new book on American activist Susan B. Anthony, abolitionist, feminist, champion for women's suffrage, and a woman arrested for trying to vote.
What I set out to do, the goal of the series was to show American history, American constitutional history, through a series of overlapping biographies. So it's based sort of on the idea that biography humanizes the past. And I had been casting around for a way to teach or, you know, make constitutional law and constitutional history accessible. So the series is 6 books and begins with Alexander Hamilton. And Susan B. Anthony is book 4. And I initially selected her because when I picked the subjects of the 6 biographies, I looked for the figures who did the most to change our Constitution. And when you change the Constitution, you really change everything about the fabric of American society and American culture. So that was why I chose her.
And she was mainly known as a woman's rights, women's suffrage advocate, but she also had other activities that she engaged in, such as the abolition movement, the temperance movement. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, she got involved in the temperance movement because of her interest in women's rights, actually. Because what happened at the time was women could not get divorced, and it was very, very difficult to get a divorce. And even if a woman could get a divorce, she was shut out of most every profession, so she had no real way to support herself. So women who got married were trapped in marriages, and if the marriage went bad, say her husband became an alcoholic, her life was just completely miserable because her husband had the right to any money she earned. So she would go out and try to earn the money, and then her husband would take it. So the only solution Susan B. Anthony could see to the problem of women entrapped with abusive and alcoholic husbands was to try to get everybody to stop drinking alcohol. And, of course, now what we know about alcoholism and, you know, that sort of thing, it maybe seemed, you know, like it wasn't going to work very well. But of the options available to her to try to help women who were trapped in these situations, the temperance movement was actually her solution to that.
Another interesting thing to me about the temperance movement is, I remember there were allies with the temperance groups, the industrialists, who didn't want their workers to come to work either drunk or hungover because it was unsafe and, you know, it would hurt productivity. So I know that was an historic partnership that was very interesting. Now, she was a Quaker born in Massachusetts?
Yeah, she was born in Massachusetts, Quaker, and her family was, actually her father was a Quaker and her mother was not, and her mother never converted. But she, Susan B. Anthony, did identify with her father's religion, and she became an active member of her local Quaker church as soon as she was old enough.
And if you could, say, capsulize in one or two sentences what makes Quakers stand out, I want to say pacifism. Am I right?
Well, in Susan B. Anthony's life, generally I think that's the first thing people think about, but that wasn't what governed Susan B. Anthony's life. What governed Susan B. Anthony's life was this Quaker idea of what we might call radical egalitarian, which is all people are equal. And this is what got the Quakers in trouble originally in England, why they came here, because they didn't understand a hierarchy of, lords and noblemen, and they didn't like any of that.
Right.
So Susan B. Anthony was completely governed by the idea that all people are completely alike, women, African-Americans, and she was such a radical egalitarian that she wouldn't even take credit for her own work because all human beings are alike. So the Quaker idea that all people were completely equal was also much more radical at the time than the idea of pacifism.
What do you see as the sort of takeaways or legacy of Miss Anthony? And I know at certain times she was helped by others like Elizabeth Cady Stanton. If we look back at her life, 100 years ago, or let's say, or more than 100, what do you think are the most salient points of her life?
One of the interesting things about her life is that she spent her entire life dedicated to basically just moving the needle a little bit.
Right.
So she dedicated her entire life, when she started on her road to creating equality, by the end of her life, she had moved the needle, but not much. And what's very poignant is some of the letters she wrote at the end of her life, where she said, I have to pass it on to another generation. And at another point, she said, I wish I could live 100 years to see the fruition.
Right.
And she was right that it took 100 years. And sometimes with political activists today and, you know, young people who don't like the political situation, I noticed that a lot of people want really a quick, instant solution. They want to do this and fix this and be done with the problem. And I think one of the lessons from Susan B. Anthony is that the needle moves slowly and it moves at all because some people have dedicated their lives. There's a really nice quotation. I just love to read it.
Sure.
She wrote, this is toward the end of her life, she said, we shall someday have our amendment. And this was the amendment that she didn't live to see, allowing women to vote. We shall someday have our amendment. And everybody will think it was always so, just exactly as many young people think all the privileges, all the freedoms, all the enjoyment which women now possess were always hers. They have no idea of how every single inch of ground that she stands upon today has been gained by the hard work of some little handful of women in the past. And the rights that she gained for women at the time was the right to stand up and speak in a meeting.
Any last thoughts, things that just blew you away or surprised you or some point of view or realization you'd like to get out to our audience about what you learned writing this book?
Susan B. Anthony does not get the kind of credit she deserves. We don't know about her the way we should. When I read the book, I was sort of amazed. More people know about Elizabeth Cady Stanton, but there are reasons for that, actually. But I came out of it sort of stunned that more people don't really know the details of her story.
Would like to remind everyone this has been Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. Today we were joined by author Terry Canefield discussing her new book, part of the Making of America series, Susan B. Anthony. Thank you, Terry, so much.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Tyler Pratt. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or listen to past segments. It's all at kcbx.org.